You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call. This week, I bring Damon Edwards. He's the co-founder of Rundeck and chief product officer. Now he is going all over the world, of course, as always, talking about SRE ops. He started DevOps Cafe, and he's also a content chair for Gene Kim's DevOps Enterprise Summit. Was really good to talk to him, as it just adds another one of these great leaders from DevOps the world that I've been able to kind of have conversations with to really show what they've done and how they've introduced it to the rest of the community that eventually became things like books, talks, DevOps Days, the DevOps Enterprise Summit, you name it. There's so much that you can kind of look to say, wow, these people were so involved, and I've been really lucky to get conversations with a lot of them so far. So thank you all. Of course, as always, my name is Jay Gordon. You can find me on Twitter at Jay Destro. And if you want to, you can always get in touch with me to reach out to be on the podcast. It's at On Call Nightmare. Or you can also select the other way of reaching out, which is simple email, just oncallnightmares@gmail.com. So I've been up to a bunch of stuff lately. I did this interview with Damon a couple weeks ago at the DevOps Enterprise Summit out in Las Vegas. Really nice of the group there to give me a space to do the podcast from. I really appreciate it. Gene and everyone there were great. John Willis, everybody. Thank you so much for being as cool as you were, and Damon for being on this particular episode. I've got some other stuff I've been up to lately. Went to Microsoft Ignite, did some talks, met some really cool people, and just been really lucky to get out there and do some really interesting stuff lately. So, got some more stuff coming up in the future. Going to be heading out to places like Denmark, Copenhagen. Copenhagen, Denmark. Pardon me. I'm going to be going to Amsterdam, going to Stockholm, Sweden, and be doing some interesting stuff also here around New York City. So if you ever are interested in being on the podcast, you're in town, I'm trying to build a little studio here. I actually upgraded my microphone at home, so I think I sound a little bit better, but you can all tell me. Anyway, here's this week's interview with Damon. I really do hope you enjoy it. You're listening to On Call Nightmares podcast, and not every week quite as much anymore, but pretty dang often I bring you conversations with technologists who've spent time on call, and I am lucky enough to meet someone who I believe is part of a huge part of the DevOps revolution that we've seen in the last few years, and person that I think has got a lot to say about being on call, or at least dealing with it. His name's Damon Edwards. Damon, tell me a little bit about what you do at Rundeck.
Yeah, so I'm one of the co-founders of Rundeck. My title officially is Chief Product Officer.
Mm-hmm.
That means nothing. I do all kinds of things in the product, a lot of evangelism, work a lot with our customers. And really, if you think about what, Rundeck, it's an open source project. It's been around since 2011. We've only really had a company around it for the last couple of years. And the reality is people came to us and said, mm-hmm. Rundeck changed my life, right? And I'm like, well, okay, what do you mean, right? And they're like, oh, because it's usually because it involves, incidents, right? That
mm-hmm.
that it was the thing that I kept getting woken up in the middle of the night, or people kept bothering me to do the same things over and over again, or I needed a place where I could stitch together. I understood all. I have all my tools. I have all my scripts. Where do I take all the knowledge, put it somewhere quickly that I can then use to orchestrate and drive all of that, all of those commands, scripts, and API calls, so I can then hand off to somebody else.
Sure.
So they can be effective in the firefighting too, right? So instead of escalating up the stream,
mm-hmm.
We can start to diagnose and solve things kind of at that first responder level. So Rundeck as a general project, and my co-founders and I all have an operations background, which we can get into
sure.
Later, but it realized we kind of realized, this is the thing people are struggling with, right? Is and how do they encapsulate the knowledge that they need to respond to diagnose or resolve incidents? So basically what I've been, marinating in as kind of return to my operations roots is folks who are on call, folks who are And it's not just on call 3 a.m, it's on call all day, every day, right?
Yeah.
Someone's knocking on their door, hey, can you check this out? Can you fix this? Do you know why this is slow? Did you change anything over there? All these little mini incidents that affect their lives.
And, you know, we're here at the, you know, DevOps Enterprise Summit. One of the big things that we've heard from people that I think is important is creating cultures of psychological safety. And I feel like that putting good controls and good processes and the tools that can help lead to psychological safety.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. So I want to get into a little bit about your start. I won't go too far back, but your start goes back a little bit earlier than mine. I got started around 2000. You kind of got into it as a systems engineer around, what, 97?
Yeah, 97, 98. I was pre-med in college, and I said, you know, I don't really have the passion to do this, you know. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I was actually tutoring for an SAT company. And they would actually go to happy hour with these guys that had an early ISP, Ray Yoshioka, Marshall Rockwell. You know, they had it called Software Networks. Eventually got bought by Digital Island and all that. But cause, so basically like, hey, you want to come hang out and see if you can figure stuff out and get a job? And I was like, sure. So that was my kind of part-time. I was working in school, and I was working with these early co-location, you know, customers, and we'd have to do on-call. Everybody had to work the 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. Shift.
So this is like your first real on-call job is your first real gig.
Exactly.
Huh?
Well, my very first gig was doing DNS entries. Which,
me too.
If you know anything about the early days of the web, the only people that could afford high-speed co-location were also people that had some very interesting domain names.
Yeah.
So if you get my drift. So,
sure. I was there. I remember it.
Well, first on a totem pole, you had to read the first 5 chapters of the DNS and Bind book, and you know, do some VI text editing off of people's email requests. Those are the days. But you know, those on calls, it's interesting because it really, you learn that, you think, how hard could it be?
Yeah.
Right? And you kind of learn that reality is nothing like practice, right? And you know, one of the things that I think has come back around that you know, John Allspaugh, I heard him say the other day, that just kind of things that only when you've been on call do you understand, is that fear that when the first light goes off, somewhere in the back of your mind you go, is this the big one?
Right? It's so true.
Is it just something flapping and then it's like, I gotta go restart something, or it's gonna clear itself up, or is this gonna go red? And is it the one that puts us out of business, right? And am I the person at the helm when we go out of business? So, you know, kind of from the early days, you know, you realize that, you know, operations is an animal onto itself, and it's something you can never really fully grasp until you're in that seat, right? Until you're actually under live fire, right?
I think Andrew Clay-Schaefer shared something this past week on Twitter that really made me laugh. And it was like, Dev is from like the universities and ops is from the streets. And I was trying to figure out what he meant, but people that come from ops, I think we appreciate the fact that failure is a big part of what we do.
Yeah.
And while I remember my early portions of my career, failure felt like such a blow.
Yeah,
you know, when that one site went down, it was long for a while, and you know, the site being the big issue, yeah. and having to, I guess, understand that I'm not the fault, I'm not the reason why this, and so it took years of being on call to stop blaming myself. I think
it's interesting you go back to the psychological safety idea, right? Because if you think about it, this is another, I'll quote some more Allspaugh here, but there's this actually all the system safety, the safety science folks, right? You know, Woods, Decker, Cook, you know, a lot of the academics that are coming into our world now, and bringing what they learned in aircraft disasters, nuclear power plant meltdowns, and operating room disasters, that, you know, why psychological safety is so important is because, you know, we really can't see the work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a line. Everything that's above the line is the stuff that we do, working with an IDE or a command line, or, you know, we have these kind of thin, very thin abstractions that we work with. And we really can't see what goes on beneath it. We have an idea in our head. We think we know what it is.
Mm-hmm. But we read a little bit of the code. Maybe we grok it. Maybe we don't. It depends on what language. But as the ops people,
it's not reality, right? Because there's a complex system under there that we can't really see. But we all have to work together on this thing that we can't see.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have these mental abstractions in our head that we're trying to to keep aligned, and we think are aligned, but if we could actually could read each other's brains, we'd be like, whoa, that's different than I see it. So when you don't have that psychological safety, when you have that feeling of blame, you know, the shame, the I gotta hide my mistakes, that's just terrible for that building that shared mental model and working together. That's why it's so important. And so, you know, it's not just like being nicer to people, right? In fact, it's nothing about being nice. It's actually about performance of the system, that unless we get people to work better together and to not hide, when you feel shame, when you feel like you're responsible, something's wrong, you hide things, that makes things worse, right? You're less likely to speak up. We're less likely as an organization to learn from these things because, well, I don't want any of that stink, you know, on
nobody wants the... There's been things where you don't want the legacy of a bad thing associated with you,
right.
But that bad thing associated with you when it comes to actual technical practice or something that's been deployed, we've come to learn that that blame game doesn't work anymore. Like, I've spent years remembering what boss asking, why did this happen and who was on, you know.
Right, whose fault is it? Right, exactly.
And we know that that doesn't create people having environments where they feel like they can speak up, where they can invite new ideas into conversations. And so I feel like we're in a much better place than we were that 20 to 25 years ago, because I think the whole idea of, well, it works on my computer, so you better figure it out.
Yeah, and the reality is that when you're a developer, you see the world in a very deterministic way, right? Like, because you're working on a simple, it could become complicated, but it's a simple system. Nginx is a simple, in of itself, running in isolation, is a complicated but simple system. And you know that you make a code change, it either builds or it doesn't. It either starts or it doesn't. It's a very deterministic world. But when you put that together with the work of hundreds of other people that's now running in an environment that's being managed and run by, you know, all kinds of other random things, you got a meteor shower that causes a power spike that causes some weird latency and some line, or you know, you've got all, it becomes a, and you have all the unpredictable behavior of users, right? That it now becomes a complex system. In complex systems, you can't, you never have perfect data about it. You can't decompose it and break it down and understand it, and you can't fully control it, right? So you can only try to build kind of self-regulation into it. So because of that, failure is going to happen. Failure is always going to happen. And then we have this human, going back to your point, there's a human intrinsic need to make sense of things.
We want safety. We want to feel secure in what we're doing.
Yeah, so what we do is we tell linear stories that put blame on something. We feel better we can blame something. It was, even going back to the early, you know, hundreds of years, it was an act of God, right? It puts blame somewhere else. And then we know that we can this basically tell this linear story that said, because this, I'm doing the five whys, because this, that's the problem, right? And the reality is that's just a political distinction. We just decided to stop there. Right, so that's not actually what happened. If you look at the broader picture, there's probably an infinite number of contributing factors and routes we could have gone down to that. We just decided to pick a person and call that person out and say, "Oh, it's human error, hindsight bias. They should have known." But the reality is, probably what all those people were doing is what they do every single day, and it still goes right. And that one time combination of factors is when it goes wrong. We then want to jump as human beings and go, I want a linear path, I want to know whose fault it is, and I want to get on fixing that problem instead of understanding the broader system that we're working in.
And to really give you a real world, not human cause that you saw, I think after this incident, globally you saw changes, was Hurricane Sandy. Hurricane Sandy, especially for people like myself on the East Coast, was a reminder that no matter how much planning you make, and this goes specifically to the people like BuzzFeed and BuzzFeed, and Gawker. Then there's Gawker was down.
There was
BuzzFeed, there was Gawker. They went down also, and I think whatever. There's another social
there's
media.
A lot of, yeah, yeah.
And the one thing they did was they put a lot of their data center equipment at like this data center in Water Street over in Manhattan, which is right next to the water on Wall Street. And so they made all these great plans about how to have redundancy and making sure that systems, as complex as they are, would work. But you can't always be ready. You can't always prepare. And I think that that's one of the cool things that I've had conversations with people in the last like couple years, is that Sandy kind of reminded a lot of people that we can still blame things on a isolated incident, like a huge storm, but it still gives us huge points about what we forgot. Like, did we think about failover as a simple mechanism, or is it a more complex mechanism that we still need manual intervention?
What, I don't know if you know Charity Majors, but
yeah.
She's great at distilling down some reality. It's a very good soundbite. She had one that was it's kind of like the complexity of the issue I was talking about, which is in these distributed systems, these complex systems, there is a seemingly infinite number of almost impossible failure scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
That in hindsight, you could have been like, oh, we should have a test for that. But you never would have. It's this perfect magic bullet through the world. And, mm-hmm. and that infinite number of these problems is why it's why the AI ops idea just doesn't really fly, because we're looking in hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
But those things never happen again. The people, so that the people who get better and better at resiliency, people who get better at operations, the incidents they deal with, they still have tons of incidents, and the randomness and the weirdness of it only increases.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you're chasing this ghost that you'll never catch, this elusive perfection, because
that extra nine you want to get to zero.
We're dealing with this complex system. So the only way to really go about it is turn it on its head and say, look, failure is going to happen. Let's understand, this is the whole kind of safety one ideas. That we're going to investigate problems,
mm-hmm.
right? Why did that happen? Safety two is saying, why did it work, right? How did it ever go right in the first place?
Yeah, how did this get through all the testing that we put in place?
No, I mean, how did the system even run on a day-to-day basis?
Gotcha,
why is the system up even now, right?
Sure, sure.
Because the same thing people are doing that's going to cause it someday to go. The things that people are doing right now are probably what's going to cause your next. It's probably going to cause a disaster someday in your system. It's just the right confluence of events that's going to make that happen. So the safety two idea, which just goes to the system, the science, folks who also talk about the psychological safety, but it's saying that, hey, we need to study why these things work in the first place, so we can understand why they break,
mm-hmm.
because we can't think of it as failure is this thing that we're going to root out.
Gotcha.
And we're going to get rid of it. We're never going to get rid of it. So we got to understand why things go right and spend as much time trying to protect ourselves by encouraging the behavior that makes things go right, and then be prepared to respond quickly to the things that go wrong.
Sure. So I want to get to the next big part of the podcast, and in order for me to get to that podcast section, I have some rules. They're very, very simple rules.
All right.
I don't like to give people rules. It's not a big thing of mine, because I'm a punk rocker and rules are kind of crappy to me. But the rules of the podcast are simple. One, I'd love you to tell me a story, but I don't want you to incriminate yourself.
Sure.
I don't want you to incriminate others, because we don't incriminate people, because all of our retrospectives are blameless, and I want you to help us learn, because this podcast, like every single episode of this podcast, is a retrospective.
Yeah.
So I'd like to give you the microphone for a minute or two. Why don't you tell me about a nasty situation or incident that maybe you remember?
Well, it's kind of funny that you know we spent a lot of time working in enterprises before I was a vendor show. We had a consulting organization and worked a lot of DevOps transformations, but from the ops towards dev kind of side of things. And you see these different incidents, and a lot of it's crazy is how many the cost of incidents
mm-hmm.
that nobody knows happen, or they have a vague recollection that it happened. Because it's never the Big Bang outage. Sure, that happens once in a while. That mm-hmm. costs you a lot of money. But it's all the death by a thousand not so tiny cuts that really bleed an organization dry. And one of my favorite ones was an insurance-ish, health-ish type type company. But
sure.
They had a problem where it's a national organization. They've got thousands of a couple thousand call center, maybe 2,000 or 1,500 call center professionals. And they had this problem where right before New Year's, which mm-hmm. is important in the insurance and healthcare world, before Christmas break or for Christmas, they had this issue where suddenly in the middle of the day, like about noon,
mm-hmm.
Eastern, they'd get this massive slowdown, and all the customer service systems would go down to basically would almost grind to a halt.
Right? Okay.
And then it would go away a few hours later, and it happened. And then everyone on Christmas vacation, it never happened again. Everyone's like, what? What's going on here? And each time, all the monitoring is green. Everything's great, right? And then they come back January 4th, whatever it was, and all hell breaks loose, right? It's just, everything's grinding to a halt. Everybody's upset. And so they pull together, you know, this war room, right? And they bring everybody in there. And every day this goes on where this massive performance problem, it's almost a stop work problem, it goes away, and it goes away in a few hours. They realize, well, this goes with the pattern of the traffic load of the East Coast is going offline. That's helping things out. Finally, the issue, they think there's network issues. They think they've chased a bunch of, you know, this is the favorite one is what changed? Well, let's chase that, right? And what it came, and then they isolate down to, well, there's a data, something wrong with the data, with the database. And they called up, they needed the vendor to come in, right? But of course, they only brought the bronze support because somebody thought that was a good idea. So literally crying and begging, pleading, finding the vendors like on faith because we can't get the procurement thing through because the procurement people are like, well, why are we going to suddenly spend $100,000 for this, you know?
Sure.
Whatever. And they said, forget it. So the vendor, luckily for them, sent a partner consultant in like the next day. Looks at it, comes back, goes away and goes, well, what's up with this stored procedure? And they basically had this stored procedures used everywhere that had like 400 or 500 different arguments every time. It was in, so it can't be seen this in the code. It was a million line stored procedure. Basically, like the entire business's logic was being run in this stored procedure. And what happened was is somebody did, unbeknownst to anybody, did a database upgrade, just a kind of a point release.
Sure.
And it turned on some statistic thing for used for for a good visibility, good analysis of the database performance, and that. Was choking on that stored procedure, and things were grinding to a halt.
So,
a
vendor provided tool that ended up just.
It was a feature that just came in the next point. It's like one of those list of 37 things.
Sure.
In the next release, it's like, oh, guess what? You got new stats, right? It's going to help you with performance management. So, they showed them how to turn that feature off, right? But this is where it gets fun. Is they everything goes back to normal. So, the best part was they went to the engineering organization, and they're like, look. Vendor was like almost laughing, like this is like ridiculous, like they've never seen this before, right? And they work with the biggest people on around. How are we going to fix this? And they're like, well, it's already fixed. You turned off the stats thing. And they're like, yeah, but some new feature is going to come along, it's going to break it, or someone's going to turn it back on, right?
Yeah, or someone's going to think this is something that's useful for us,
right? And they're going to forget about this and turn it back on. And the development organization dug their heels and like, no, you have a workaround. Problem solved. We have business features to worry about. Don't do that. And then the best part was is when we were looking at this incident, some executives came by and they're like, what are you guys looking at? And I'm like, oh, remember the performance issue around New Year's? Like, oh, yeah, that was annoying. Oh, yeah, good, yeah, yeah. And then they kind of, walked along and it sort of vaguely remembered there was some little blip. What they don't realize is those 30 to 40 people that day in, day out were in the war room, on the bridge calls, whatever, plus the slowdown of the customer service agents. If you actually went through and did the full look, say afterwards, it was over $1 million was the cost of that incident, and nobody knew what happened, right? That it just wasn't on the register, and they took $1 million outside in the courtyard, effectively, and lit it on fire.
It's so
and
weird.
Nobody actually would see that. So, but we focus on the major instance that cost us money. Those kinds of things happen day in, day out. It's a very dramatic one, but happens day in, day out in large organizations. And those are the problems that are actually the most worth solving. The major incidents are going to happen, and you want to resolve them quickly. But the big savings comes from being able to solve those day in, day out, brownout things. Because if you look at those and really look at what they cost, that $1 million doesn't even include the cost of delay or the brand goodwill. It's literally just direct labor and slowdown cost across the customer service, development, all the different teams they had to pull in over those like couple weeks where they were pulling their hair out.
And it also creates for the vendor themselves, the database vendor, a lack of trust in the actual product, because if you're going to put things that are part of it, and it's so funny, I worked for a database company for a while in Mongo, and the one thing that people always used to say, and it's so funny that you mentioned it this way, is what will this upgrade change that I need to be aware of? And sometimes it's the smallest little things. Whether it's and it doesn't even have to be a database. It can be any part.
This is why trying to think that you're going to be a deterministic system.
Sorry for the quick break, but we had some people walk in the room. Why don't you go ahead and continue?
No worries. So I'd say that what's interesting is the change management function of that organization that was put in place because of all of these problems, because of all of these issues that they had. Very ITIL heavy, change process. It doesn't catch those problems because to them it's like, sure, you can. It's just a little point release upgrade, on the database. we reviewed it, what's really going to go wrong? It's kind of that fool's errand of we're in a deterministic system that we can act, that some external force can analyze a change and be like, is this going to work or not? You know, I told at the conference here last year, I did this, if you look at the talk, it's called the Last Mile. I did this whole cartoon where it's basically like this tale of woe of it's true, another real incident that happened in this organization. And it all came down to that, oh, we have to get business approval from these VPs who are then going to ping the technology VPs to restart some web services in the middle of the day to say, sure, it's a web service. How hard can it be? They didn't know there was a firewall rule that nobody knew. The firewall rule that was changed between these two services there was a health check in one of the services that needed to talk to another service, but they made the firewall change because that service is supposed to be deprecated, but the health check wasn't changed. And cascading failure, everything stopped. So basically went from being, oh yes, how hard could it be, approved four levels up, and that was just part of the tale of woe. And that idea, the illusion of external, the common theme is that sort of the siloization of things, people working independently of each other, and then the external command and control culture, you know, we've seen for decades that those two combinations just don't work well together.
Very cool. So let me start rolling this to the end, because I know you got a big day ahead of you. I know I do too. And I want to finish up by asking you, if someone's on call, and this is a two-pronged question. First of all, if someone's on call and you're their manager, what's the best piece of advice you can give that manager right now?
That's the advice I can give a manager on call. To me, it would be...
I know it's a tough one.
What's part two?
If someone is on call right now and they're listening to you, and maybe they've only been in this industry for a year, 2 years, maybe this is their first on-call role, what's a piece of advice you'd give that person?
So, okay, I'll start with the manager, one. And I think the piece of advice I would have is treat an incident like it's a process and do a retrospective on that process and on the actual processes. So just like you would look at a project delivery and say, let's walk through and like it's a factory and do the kind of lean analysis of it, those incidents are processes. They're just maybe ad hoc processes that happen or one-off processes. And really walk through and understand the work of each one. Because too many times managers live, I think, in the what should have happened.
Sure.
Or they get the secondhand, what are the action items out of that incident. Whereas I think you have to go to the Gemba in the lean sense and actually sit and tell the story with the people who were involved to understand what actually happened. Not should have happened or would have happened or does happen, but on that Tuesday when that went wrong, walk me through from when the first whiff of it came through to where we felt like we were out of the woods. You have to go to the Gemba and walk in it. Otherwise, you're not going to understand what you need to change.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was saying something best to for people on call, I'd say it's to up their feeling of accountability. And accountability in the sort of in the military sense or in the safety science sense is not about your account. You know, your
it's not blame.
It's not blame. It's actually you can tell the story.
Sure.
Right. Do you have the facts? Do you have? Are you good at account? At giving an account of what happened? That's actually accountable. Actually means in the technical sense is are you? Can you give the full account of what happened? There's responsibility somewhere else, but can you give a full account? And I think being able to, there's not much you can do really to change the system around you, other than learn how to project the information, learn how to visualize it, learn how to tell the stories, and provide the visual representation, and to explain to those around you what's going on. Because that information is the best thing that you could hope to do. And then hopefully you will get good management to kind of sync up coming the other way and use that to say, this is not good. This is a waste of human capital. Or this could be improved because, you know, we're going to be able to resolve incidents quicker. But that's those as close to the keyboard have to turn around and learn how to radiate that information effectively upward.
Perfect. That's such a great piece of information. So, Damon, thank you very much for being part of this today. Is there any way people can get in touch with you if they'd like to talk to you more about some of these subjects or if they just want to learn more about Rundeck?
Sure, yeah. You can rundeck.com. Obviously, I'm Damon at rundeck.com, Damon at rundeck.com. You can hit me on Twitter if that's your thing, at Damon Edwards. Generally finds me.
Awesome. So thanks a lot. We've been here at the DevOps Enterprise Summit 2019 in Las Vegas, and I am just, you know, I get to talk to a lot of really awesome people at these events. It's rare that I get to talk to the people I feel that build the foundation for what it is I do now. Mm-hmm. So thanks a lot for being part of this today, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thanks for having me. You do a great job with this podcast, and I hope it keeps going for a long time.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, that's another really cool interview, and this time with Damon Edwards of Rundeck. Thanks a lot for your time, Damon. I really do appreciate it. To all the leaders and everyone that I got to speak with at the DevOps Enterprise Summit, really did have a great time, and I thank you for giving me some of yours. So if you'd like to give me some of your time and be on the podcast, it's really easy. Send an email to oncallnightmares@gmail.com or reach out to me on Twitter @oncallnightmare. So that's it for this week. Check back next time. Well, I have another conversation with a technologist who spent time on call. We'll see you then.